What happens if you miss one of the windows, 26 months windows, to bring a space shuttle to Mars? Is it game over?
I mean, if we miss the launch window to go to Mars, it means that the mission would be off for that launch period. But the crew does not leave Earth unless its return vehicle has already been positioned on Mars and has successfully produced its propellant. So if the crew misses its launch window, you know, they've got 2 years in which to do something else on Earth. Maybe look for a job. But they're not in danger.
There's a couple of other high-profile spokespeople, I suppose, for the case for Mars of different types of missions, one being Mars One and the other being Buzz Aldrin's proposals. Would you like to comment on each of those?
Yeah, sure. Let me take Buzz's first. Buzz's is a serious proposal with which I happen to disagree. That is, you could implement Buzz's program, but it involves an awful lot of precursors and intermediate objectives, which would therefore extend the schedule of the program, increase the cost, and also increase the programmatic risk that the program would be canceled in midstream. I think that a Humans to Mars program is kind of like an army moving through hostile territory subject to ambush at any time. Okay, you know, you can only push your luck so far. If Kennedy in 1961 had said, I want to get to the moon by 1990 instead of 1970, the program probably would have been canceled somewhere along the way and we never would have made it to the moon. So I just think that Buzz's schedule is too extended and that therefore, I mean, it's entirely feasible in principle. There's nothing, I have no technical criticisms of it, but my programmatic criticism is that. The Mars One thing, first I want to dismiss a slander against Mars One in that it's a suicide mission. You go to Mars One way, it's committing suicide. No, it's not a suicide mission, it's a settlement mission. Okay. Now that said, to be approached properly as a settlement mission, you have to put in place a logistical organization, including financial logistics, to fund not just the first mission, but the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the tenth, the 20th, and the 50th. Okay, in other words, what a settlement mission is not sending some people to Mars one way and saying good luck. It's you're sending people to Mars one way, and then you're going to send more people and more equipment and more supplies and more of everything, and you're going to keep doing this, enlarging the settlement, reinforcing it until you take the continent and you take the planet. Okay, that's what that is. Now, from a technical point of view, the Mars One plan is the simplest plan. Okay, it's easier to fly to Mars one way than round trip. You don't have to develop all the round trip hardware. The flight risk is actually less because you don't have all the flight risk associated with return flight. Okay, and the cost, of course, is less because you don't have to pay for the development or the delivery of all these return systems. But it does require this sort of logistical backup. Now, my serious question about Mars One is, well, first of all, there's a real question of whether, I mean, look, right now they have no significant resources, okay? And I don't think that their business plan of funding a Mars mission based on a reality TV show is remotely realistic, even if they got a reality TV show, which they might get, that could happen. Such an enterprise could raise millions of dollars, not billions of dollars. It's off by three orders of magnitude. Even accepting, which I'm willing to accept Bas Lansdorf's estimate that they could do the first Mars One mission for $5 billion. That's much less than government estimates, but if you did these things in the private world, $5 billion is a lot of cookies. But he doesn't have $5 billion or half a billion dollars, okay? And you're not going to get one from a reality TV show. But even if you did, even if Bill Gates was to take a fancy to Mars One and say, okay, boss, I'm going to give you $5 billion. You can fly this mission. That's not good enough, because the one-way mission requires a continuous colonization effort. Now, it's not unprecedented to have such things. If you look at some of the most daring colonization episodes in human history, the most unlikely, the Pilgrims going to Massachusetts in 1620, the Mormons going to Utah in 1846, the Jews going to Palestine in the early 20th century, in all cases, the colonists who actually went were supported by large home front organizations which raised the money to send those colonists and to keep sending more people, more supplies, more support of every type. Okay. But that's what you need here. If you're going to do this kind of colonization enterprise, we need a Mars settlement society to back it up. Probably international organization that could raise the money to keep funding this thing. In principle, it's not impossible. I mean, look, there's 7 billion people on the planet, about a billion living in the advanced sector where people have, you know, spare change, and at least 10% of those people, and I think it could easily be more than 20%, but let's say 10, believe it is important for a positive human future that humans expand into space. That's 100 million people. 100 million people times $100 a year would be $10 billion a year. That would absolutely be enough to fund the colonization of Mars. Okay? But it's a question of pulling that together. I mean, the harvest is plentiful, but the gatherers are few. Someone's got to pull that together. And whether Bas Lansdorf has the wherewithal to create such a global organization, both in terms of financial resources, organizational abilities, you know, and all sorts of things, that's questionable, okay? But I do think that someday someone will. Okay? Someday Mars will get its Theodore Herzl, and then this thing can go like that. But I think Mars One's a long shot.
What happens if the lander lands in, like, a hole or a bit of a trench? What would happen? Like,
can you...
like, if it gets damaged.
What happens if the lander gets damaged?
Yes.
Or what if it lands in, like, a bad place, like a deep trench or something?
Yeah.
Right. That's a good question. Well, you see, here's the thing. The crew in this mission does not come home in the same rocket that they went out to Mars in. They come home in an Earth return vehicle that has been landed on Mars before they leave Earth. So we will know before we decide to launch the crew to Mars that they have an Earth return vehicle that is ready to go, that is not only fueled, but is in good condition for launch. And that's why this is actually a safer plan than the kind of plan that a lot of people think about, where they have the crew landing on Mars in the same ship they're going to take off in. Because in that case, you don't know in advance that after it has landed, that thing's going to be in good enough shape to fly. So in this mission, we already know that the ascent vehicle has survived the potential damage it might have faced in a hard landing. We know that it has gotten through that before we send the people.
Hi, Robert. Just back to the Mars One issue again. There has been a lot of doubt about the validity of the mission and how successful it can be, more recently in the media. What do you think a mission like this, perhaps failing, should it do so, would do to public perception about Mars missions, such as the more successful and more probable missions such as yours?
Well, by failing, do you mean that it fails programmatically and never sends a mission and thus disappoints all these people that have volunteered, or that it actually raises enough money to do a mission and that mission fails?
I don't think it would raise enough money, but more likely the first case.
Well, okay, so you're saying that the thing just that proves to be a straw in the wind and it's sort of a little scandal, it's potentially a negative development. I have met a fair number of Mars One candidates, and while some of them are a little loose around the edges, a fair number of them are people of high ability and character. And I would say that in this final 100 that they have down selected to, there's 20 or 30 of them that absolutely would make the greatest candidates for the NASA Astronaut Corps. Okay. These people, you might consider them unrealistic, optimistic, idealistic, but they're not kooks. And many of them have serious technical credentials and really are very attractive characters. And I hope that these people do not become made cynical if Mars One should fail to go anywhere. What I'm hoping, well, first of all, I'm trying to recruit them to the Mars Society, not just to Mars Society, trying to make the Mars Society bigger, which would be a nice thing, but no, that's not my objective. My objective is to show them that, yes, you're right, and what Bas Lansdorf is saying is true in as much as humans to Mars is one of the greatest things that someone who's alive in this period of history could contribute to. But you don't have to contribute to it by personally going to Mars as a Mars One colonist. You can contribute to it by being an engineer who develops technologies to enable the flight. You can contribute to it by being a writer who helps spread the vision. There's any number of ways that someone can contribute to this great adventure other than by going as a colonist. And by the way, I mean, look, who did more to get us to the moon, okay, Arthur Clarke or Buzz Aldrin? Or Wernher von Braun or Buzz Aldrin? Okay, the guy that actually flew the mission was probably the least essential in the overall scheme of things than the people who sold the concept or who developed the technology.
So Elon Musk has made it quite obvious his aims to get to Mars. And it's probably more a realistic chance than any other company, especially with their new Raptor engine. Have you spoken to him, or what do you think of his idea for getting to Mars?
Okay, yes, yeah, so I know Elon Musk. I've spoken to him quite a few times. And you're right. SpaceX is probably the most hopeful development of these. It's by far the most hopeful development of these private enterprise things that people talk about. Okay, I mean, this is real, and it's not just real; it's profound. He has demonstrated an ability to develop new space systems in 1/3 the time and 1/10 the development cost than has been generally accepted in the aerospace industry in the recent period. And not only that, he's now demonstrating an ability to develop things that the regular aerospace industry hasn't been able to develop, such as reusable launch vehicles. He's not quite there, but he's getting pretty close. And I'm quite willing to bet anyone here that Musk is going to succeed at that. Okay, so that's remarkable stuff. Now, okay, first of all, the most obvious contribution of that is that the availability of such hardware, including fairly soon something semi-heavy launch vehicle, the Falcon Heavy, 53 tons to Earth orbit, having that available greatly lowers the cost threshold and therefore the decision threshold for politicians to decide on initiating a Humans to Mars program. Because, I mean, look, Humans to Mars, there's a lot of things that the government does, you know, various military adventures somewhere that are controversial in themselves. Not everybody supports it. Even if you could convince them this is going to win, they say, but we shouldn't do that. Whereas Humans to Mars, very few people anyway, are against Humans to Mars as such. There are people who are against Humans to Mars because they say the money could be better spent on other things. Well, the less it costs, the less potent that argument is. Okay, and so if you have hardware development that makes it clear that Humans to Mars can be done for tens of billions of dollars and not hundreds of billions of dollars, then it becomes a much more attractive prospect. So that's point one. Point two is, by showing that things can be developed cheaply, even things that haven't been developed at a certain point, he's making clear can be developed in an expeditious and cost-effective way, and once again lowering the threshold on both cost and schedule. And, I mean, just bringing back the confidence. You know, Saturn V, the contract to start the development of the Saturn V was cut in 1962. It flew the first time in 1967. That's 5 years from program start. Okay, you go back in time, the P-80, which was the first American jet fighter, was 90 days from program start to first flight. Okay, and in fact, I was just in Adelaide with a gentleman who has a little aerospace company there, and he showed me a first, well, not a jet fighter, but it was an Australian fighter in World War II.
Boomerang.
Yes, the Boomerang, developed in a few months. Right now, they take decades to develop a fighter. Okay, you know, the heavy lift booster, the SLS. You know, they want to take 15 years to develop this thing. And it's really longer than that because the SLS is just a variant of the Shuttle C that people have been toying with its design since the early 1980s. Okay? And they're going to take 40 years to bring it to flight. Okay? Whereas the Saturn V took 5. Okay? You know, the Orion capsule, that program was begun in 2004. They're not going to fly it with people in 2022 compared to the Apollo capsule took 5 years to develop. Okay? Musk is breaking that paradigm and showing, yeah, we can really still do stuff. Okay? It wasn't just these demigods of the past that could do things like Apollo. Okay? We can do this. This can be done by actual living people. And so, you know, just, you know, it's breaking people out of this impotent mindset where everything has to take forever. Okay? And I think that's really important as a psychological shock. Now, what about this idea? What if the government never goes for it? Can Musk do it? Well, maybe. Perhaps Musk is somebody that, having developed most of the hardware, could help pull together this global Mars settlement organization. He certainly has a lot more resources at his disposal than Mars One. Okay, you know, or maybe somebody else pulls together that organization and they make use of Musk hardware to do it. Whether he's willing to fund it directly out of his own pocket, I'm not so sure. Musk does amazing things. He likes to make money while he does it. And not because he's greedy, but because he knows that if he does that, he'll be able to keep doing other things. Okay. But anyway, yeah, SpaceX is great stuff. If I was a young engineer just getting out of college, that's where I'd want to go.
First of all, thanks very much for your presentation this evening. I've had to change my question because of the previous question. I'd be interested in your view on whether you think the group that would be sponsoring this first project would be like a country base like America, China, or somebody else, or whether it would be more likely to be a multinational approach, or whether there would be room for the private enterprise as coming in and also being part of that project?
Well, there's a lot of possibilities here. There's a fellow right over there, Sean Moss, has written a book on international mission to Mars. And, you know, in the 90s, that was all the rage because it had seemed like the world had come together. The Cold War was over, and now we could get together and do some really great stuff like this together. Okay? That might seem to be a very implausible idea right now. On the other hand, it might be all the more necessary precisely because the international situation is deteriorating, where you say, everybody says, look, okay, this thing's going to hell in a handbasket. How do we turn this around? Maybe what we want to do is go orthogonal and pull together and make it that we all want to turn this around and use the Mars mission to pull the World Bank together again. On the other hand, I mean, look, obviously, the way we got to the moon the last time, we didn't go to the moon because of the Cold War, but we certainly, the people who wanted to go to the moon certainly took advantage of the energies that were available, as it were, under Cold War competition to get the moon mission funded and get there. It's quite possible that we end up going to Mars because of a new Cold War, where America decides we need to once again astound the world with what free people can do. Okay? And what better way than humans to Mars? And I got to tell you, I was in Leningrad when we landed on the moon in 1969, and they got the message. And it was a very positive message, by the way. So all the Russians knew, yeah, Molodets. I mean, the leadership must have been having kittens, but the people in the street, they were looking at this and they were seeing us excel, as it were, in a sport that they appreciated. Here it is. Now, or, yes, private. We kind of discussed this in the previous question. What if Musk develops the hardware? What if Musk or somebody else pulls together a Mars settlement organization, Mars Settlement Society that can fund this thing? And especially once the cost threshold is brought down enough by the fact that the hardware is there, maybe it could be done. Maybe we're looking at the Pilgrim paradigm here. As much as we don't like it, the chances are that in the 21st century, humanity being what it is, will be fully capable of generating refugee populations. And if they come from an ethnic group or society that has got technological capabilities and they need a place to go, there's Mars. It's happened before. So it's really hard to predict this stuff. But suffice to say, all these potentialities are active.
Dr. Robert, what is the best place to land on Mars?
Well, say this again. What's the best place to land on Mars? Well, people disagree on that, but I'll tell you what I think. I'd want it to be in the tropics. Mars is cold enough as it is, but the tropics are the warmest. I'd want it to be low altitude because, Mars has very sharp topography. The lower the altitude, the thicker the air, the less the day-night temperature variations, the moister the situation is, the easier it will be to get water out of the soil, the easier it is to acquire atmosphere from the atmosphere, the easier it is to land with parachutes, and things of this sort. So I would go for low latitudes, low altitudes. I'd want to go to a place where, from orbit, where we've detected high concentrations of water in the soil. There are such places. I'd like it to be an area that is scientifically interesting with a lot of varied phenomenon within driving range, so that we could pursue science actively there. And ideally, for a permanent base, I'd like to be a place where we had discovered geothermal power available within drilling distance from the surface. Geothermal power is a very reliable kind of power, much more so than wind or sun, and it's potentially available on Mars.
So if life is found on Mars, would you think that we should still terraform Mars even if the life would become extinct, or would you say we should not terraform so we would preserve that life?
All right, great question to finish with. I want to terraform it. This is a multifaceted question, but I didn't want to keep everybody in suspense before they got my answer. First of all, if there's life on Mars, it's in Mars, it's underground, it's in the groundwater. Now, you may not know it, but you and your associates in the modern biological community have already driven the original inhabitants of the Earth underground. That is, the original inhabitants of the Earth were anaerobic bacteria that could not survive in the presence of oxygen. And so when photosynthetic plants came along and started polluting the Earth's atmosphere with oxygen, the surface of the Earth became uninhabitable by the natives. And so they went underground into the groundwater, and they are still there. And they're doing fine. In fact, they outnumber us by, like, you know, 1,000,000 to 1. And I don't just mean in numbers, I mean in mass. In numbers, it's a lot more than 1,000,000 to 1. Okay, 1,000,000,000 to 1. And they've been down there for the past 2 billion years since the surface became uninhabitable. And, you know, they've seen them come and go. They've seen the trilobites come and go, the dinosaurs come and go, the mastodons, the Vermont, you know, all this stuff. It comes, it goes, they remain, okay? And probably they'll be there after we're totally gone, okay? Now, if we go to Mars and terraform Mars, I don't think we're going to have any more impact on the subsurface biota than we've had on the Earth's subsurface biota, okay? So there is that. From a practical point of view. Now, from a philosophical point of view, though, you say, but what if it did? To me, see, because there's some people who say, or even ignoring the question of Martian biota, they say, what right do we have to terraform Mars? Doesn't Mars have a right to be the way it is? And we're just kind of ruining it by changing it because it wants to be what it is, which is to say, dead. Now, to me, this argument doesn't make sense. Look, if anybody was to propose taking the Earth and transforming it into something like Mars, everyone, whether they are, you know, greens or hardcore pro-development technologists, you know, from the oil company, we'd all agree this was nuts, right? Okay? We don't want to take the Earth and make it like Mars. Okay? That would be bad. Okay? Like, really bad. So therefore, to take Mars and make it like the Earth is really good. And the... okay? And to deny that this would be a positive act of environmental construction would be to say it's just wrong because people are doing it. Whether we make it more like Mars or more like Earth, it's wrong either way. And in fact, if we let it stay the same, it's either way because that's our fault too. It's just a total guilt trip that has no relationship to. In other words, make up your mind. Which do you like it better, live or dead? I like life. Okay. Thank you.
By thanking RMIT for hosting this event and thanking all of you for coming. Dr. Zuber, will be around for a few minutes just chatting formally after the lecture if you had some further questions.
Right. And one other thing, the Mars Society Australia and several of the other space societies are going to be having a conference in September in Canberra, I believe. And if you take the trouble to have a look at their website now or maybe in a little while, you could get information on that and perhaps go.
Yeah, thank you.